everybody. So I have a PowerPoint. I'm going to be actually moving between the PowerPoint and the board a little bit. I started the PowerPoint when I was back home, and it was giving me all these wonderful suggestions that made it so beautiful. And then I realized when I was out here that those suggestions were coming from the interweb. Like there was like it was connect. And so the last few slides don't look as gorgeous as the first few slides. Let's just put it that way. But this Welcome to Judaism, I wanted to provide some visuals just for a little bit of added excitement. And so this is some of the beauty that the PowerPoint app was suggesting to me. Like, I didn't do this. I put in pictures, and then they were like, can we suggest making it more beautiful? And I was like, yes, you can. But I thought we'd start in the beginning. We'll start at the beginning, So Judaism is rooted in the five books of Moses, the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. So on a weekly basis, I work with a scroll. We have a big scroll, the Torah scroll, on animal parchment, written by hand. And that's where I roll it. I roll the scroll to the place we're going to be reading that week and then read from the scroll on a weekly basis. And we read the whole scroll throughout the entire year. So we have a holiday called Simchat Torah, which is usually in October, and that's when we finish reading the very end and then read from the beginning from Genesis again, and the cycle starts all over. We actually take at my congregation, and you're all welcome to come, on that holiday, we unroll the entire scroll throughout the room. Wow. So people hold it, and you can actually see the all five books, and I'll go and tell the story, just because I can tell by the layout. For example, the Song of the Sea, the song that the Israelites sang when they went through the Sea of Reeds, is written differently than the rest of the scroll because poetry is laid out differently. So I can actually just tell from far away, oh, that's Song of the Sea, because it's laid out in poetic form as opposed to just the big chunks of text. In that text, in the Hebrew text, there's no punctuation. So it's really hard to find things. It's a tradition where the books begin and end and where the periods even go. So when you're reading an English translation of the Bible, the five books, know that there's many, many layers of interpretation that have already gone into that English version you're reading, including where a period is even put in that text. Deciding where to put a period is an interpretation. There are no periods. The words just flow right into each other. From context, you can often tell where the sentences might begin and end, but sometimes you can't. And so there's just such an interpretive process in dealing with this text. I often, traditionally you would chant out of it, but what I like to do is read and translate. So read and then translate in English as I'm reading, because when Ezra and Nehemiah came back from the first exile after the destruction of the first temple, they came back to the land of Israel, and one of the first things they did is say, like, we're going to have public Torah reading now. And they made it very clear that it should be in a way that people can understand the text. Not just hear it, but understand it, which means using the vernacular. We also like to use Hebrew because it's our sacred language, and so we're toggling back and forth between Hebrew and English. This week in the Torah, we're going to be reading the story of Balak and Bilam and the donkey and the angel and the curses and the blessings that come. And our bar mitzvah, the child who's coming of age, will read from the Torah, and he's also going to give a sermon. He'll give an interpretation, his own interpretation of that text at that ceremony.
Is that the talking donkey?
The talking donkey. Yes, it is.
Wow.
It's a talking donkey story. So I'm going to talk just a moment now about denominationalism within Judaism, because I know some people had some questions about that. But I wanted to be clear from the offset that I am, or the onset, that I come from the liberal Jewish tradition, which means that we don't necessarily read the Torah as the literal word of God. We believe that it's an inheritance from our ancestors, and it was divinely inspired, but not necessarily divinely written. If you believe it's divinely written, no one's going to kick you out. But by and large, we do not approach it as being divinely written. Nor do we have a big emphasis on a supernatural God. So we talk about God, but we don't necessarily talk about God as an individual or a being, but more of a force or an energy or a connector. And when we do talk about God as being a person, it's usually because we're using historical texts that expressed a different understanding of reality. We don't throw them away because they're part of our ancestry. We wrestle with them, but we keep them as like you keep things that you inherit from ancestors. It's beautiful, but it's not necessarily the same reasoning or level of intellectual honesty or integrity that you might have now. And so we're always trying to balance that between accepting the ancient and old traditions and also being intellectually honest. And that's all. That's very important in liberal Judaism. So I'm going to move over here to the board real quick.
Is it your goal?
It is my goal. That was my goal. Huh. It says on. Oh, gosh. Maybe someone will come in and fix it. I can talk louder. So
you sound fine.
Okay. So like Christianity, Judaism has major denominations. And the major divide in Judaism is between liberal or progressive Jews. And that doesn't mean that they're necessarily politically liberal or progressive, but in America, it mostly does. But not always. And then we also when we have what we call traditional or halachic, which is halacha, is exactly the same thing as Sharia. So halacha is Jewish law, Sharia is Muslim law. It's the same thing. It's the laws that govern the religion. Liberal Judaism would be post-halachic, meaning we consider Jewish law that has a vote but not a veto. Meaning, like, I wouldn't be standing here if it had a vote because women technically are not allowed to be rabbis. Why? Because in the Bible it says women, children, and slaves cannot be witnesses in a court of law. So in order for us to have women be rabbis, they need to be able to be witnesses to conversions and weddings and sign documents. They need to have the same legal standing as a man. In order to break through that, we had to basically decide in liberal Judaism, we're just not going to follow that law anymore. Like, we understand it's there, and we're not going to do it anymore. And that is a major break, because traditional or halachic Judaism at least strives to stay within the bounds of Jewish law, while liberal or post-halachic Judaism does not. So we still have services at the same time and read the same text and have a lot, same prayers, but it's really the relationship to law. Are you bound to Jewish law, to keeping the laws in a certain way, or do you not feel bound to live in that way? And that creates a lot of interesting conversation, but also divisions within the Jewish world. One major one is that the state of Israel has two legal systems. They have a secular legal system, and then they have a religious legal system. So anything in Israel that has to do with birth, death, divorce, adoption, and inheritance goes through the religious legal system for Jews. And anything else goes through the secular legal system. And that's a hard balance for the society. Any questions about halacha and post-halachic? Yeah.
Like Orthodox?
Mm-hmm. So Orthodox would be,
is that the same thing?
Right, Orthodox. So there's modern Orthodox. And modern Orthodox people would be people who keep kosher, keep the Sabbath, don't spend money or drive or use electricity on the Sabbath, keep all the holidays, and they might and usually also keep the laws of family purity. Laws of family purity are the laws that govern women's cycles, and that in the tradition, a woman would go to the ritual bath, the mikveh, to immerse after her menstrual cycle to become clean again, to be able to be with her husband. Because in biblical times, women, when they were cycling, were considered unclean and had to be separate. So this is sort of a holdover from that, and that would be in halachic tradition.
Reformed, is that the same
as
liberal?
Right. That's liberal Jew, yeah. So
okay.
Under traditional halachic, we have modern Orthodox who would follow the dietary laws, the laws of Sabbath, and the laws of family purity. But they also will work as doctors and nurses and school teachers and still go to movies, read newspapers, still do modern things, but religious, their religious life is traditional. Ultra-Orthodox or Hasidic Jews actually are much more like Mennonites or Quaker, the Quakers who live separately. They would not go to the movies or read the newspaper, unless it was a newspaper from their community. Their children would not go to public school. They dress differently, eat differently, and live a separate life. And though they are very visible, the reality is that the vast majority of Jews on this planet are liberal Jews or post-halachic Jews, including in the state of Israel. So it's because Orthodox Jews are so visible, it seems like there would be a lot of them, but that's not actually the truth. The truth is that most Jews blend into society, and that's the vast majority of people. So the liberal denominations are Reform, and I serve a Reform congregation. Not Reformed, but Reform. Conservative, which is a little bit more conservative. Reconstructionist, which is where I was ordained as a Reconstructionist rabbi. We have Renewal, that's a little bit more New Agey. And then there's also secular, humanistic, Jewish congregations. Because you don't have to believe in God to be Jewish. And I guess that's part of one of the big things to understand here is that while we have these big divisions in our civilization, fundamentally, we don't define Judaism as a religion, but rather a civilization that has a religious component to it. So there's religion, but there's also spirituality, there's language, there's food, there's land, there's art, poetry, everything that a civilization has. We're an unusual civilization in that we've been in exile, sort of dispersed for most of our history, but we still are drawn together by certain important things. Number one is the Torah, the five books of Moses. So when we read the story of Balak and Bilam, the donkey, talking donkey story, this Saturday morning, so will every other Jewish congregation in the world, regardless of whether they're liberal or traditional. And the bar mitzvah, or bat mitzvah, everywhere in the world reads the last three lines of the portion. And that's uniform. Everywhere. So while there's a lot of difference, there's actually a lot of similarity too. So we have our liberal denominations, which is the majority, and then we have Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox, and Hasidic Jews are part of ultra-Orthodox. Now, Hasidic Judaism did not start out being particularly Orthodox. Before the French Revolution, all Judaism is what we would call Orthodox or Halakhic. And the reason for that is because Jews were not allowed to live most in the rest of society, so you had to live within Jewish villages. Have you all seen Fiddler on the Roof?
Yeah.
So that story tells the story of Jews living in shtetls, in towns, where they had their rabbi and they had their own, you know, their own everything.
Yeah.
And that it wasn't until Jews were emancipated in Europe, starting with the French Revolution, where we could be citizens of the countries where we lived, that people started to, liberal Judaism started to develop. It developed first in Germany, where Jews were, once they were emancipated, started going to the universities and studying and learning. And with that learning and the exposure to secular studies, it's like, our collective brains exploded because we've been so cut off for so long from the rest of the world, and now suddenly it's like, oh, we're reading the Torah in a different way, and we're noticing that there's inconsistencies, and we're noticing that things are repeated, and so there was a more scientific approach taken to the study of Torah, which then led to liberal Judaism and the rejection of Jewish law being the only way to be a Jew. So again, we consider it, and we take it in, we factor it in, but we don't consider it to be binding in liberal Judaism. Any other questions about the denominations?
I'm just a little confused with
yes.
The secular ones. I mean, you're reading the Torah, and there's a lot about God in there, so I'm a little bit confused at that point.
So what secular Jews would say is that we inherited this book from our ancestors, but... And it's precious to us, but we don't necessarily believe in in the God that's talked about in this book. So it's more like you receive a story from your family, and it's a precious story, and it's a story you value. And we talk about this a lot in the synagogue. Doesn't matter if it's capital T true. And the example I always use is what we call Yetziat Mitzrayim, which is the Exodus from Egypt. So for thousands of years, we've been celebrating Passover, where we recount having been slaves in Egypt and being liberated. And for thousands of years, we've been celebrating that holiday in circumstances that were not ideal, including in concentration camps. So if we receive tomorrow news that it's absolutely 100% definitive that there was no exodus from Egypt ever, would it make a difference? Does it make the story any less true? Because the story is what's kept us alive. The story of redemption and believing the whole time that we were free people and that we'd already been redeemed and we're on this journey towards the promised land, that's what kept us going for 2,000 years. So whether the story is capital T true or not, doesn't matter. It's really it's the story that is what's most important. And so in liberal Judaism, we study the Torah every Saturday morning. We get a large group of people to come and study. Do most of the people in that room believe in a supernatural God? I would probably say no. That most of the people do not. If you push them and say, do you believe in a God who rewards and punishes or knows you or interacts and intercedes in this world, they would say absolutely not. So the point of studying the Torah and practicing Judaism even isn't about necessarily believing in a supernatural God. In some ways, the fact that we still exist and we're even here is sort of where our faith comes from. How is it that we've survived all this and all this time, and we have these lessons that we've carried with us and these stories? So for some people, I say some people are really hardwired for God and for a supernatural God, and that really makes sense to them. And for some people, it doesn't. And I actually happen to be one of those people who is not hardwired for a supernatural God, which is really good, because when I was a little kid, my parents told me God is everything and God is nothing, and that's what we're going to tell you about God. My dad was a rabbi also. And what that did for me was it allowed me to develop my own relationship with divinity. Yes?
I was not aware about the prohibition about living in society. And was that true worldwide, that Jews could not live in with the rest of society?
No, it wasn't true worldwide, but after sort of picking up where Terry left off last session, when he talked about 1492 and what we call the expulsion from Spain and Portugal, many Jews were living in North Africa and Spain and Portugal, and everybody was happy with Muslims and Christians, and people were enjoying themselves, the golden age of Spain, and then things changed. And at that time period, lots of Jews moved towards Central Europe. It turned out that in the late 1400s, 1500s, Poland was a super liberal place to be. And they actually wanted Jews to come. And so all the Jews ended up sort of clustering there, and that became the Pale of Settlement. I don't know if you've heard the term beyond the Pale.
Yeah.
That refers to the Pale of Settlement, which is where Jews were forced to live, and within a constricted area. And so that's why people were so consolidated during the Holocaust, just because everybody was sort of living in these condensed areas, even though they were allowed at that point to live elsewhere. But no, for example, my mother's family is from Morocco, and so we had a different experience being Jews living in Muslim countries. They didn't have the same rules or laws. In Morocco, Jews couldn't do certain professions, or there were all kinds of rules, but they weren't the same rules as in Europe. Any other questions about denominationalism and then sort of the breakdown? Yes?
It seems to me that that these two communities have very different understandings of the Abrahamic covenant in terms of God calling people to be a blessing to the world.
Mm.
When I think about the Jewish contributions to the arts and sciences, which has been so amazing, that couldn't happen in the traditional, apparently, if they're staying. So,
in the ultra-Orthodox, that's true. They wouldn't be, but modern Orthodox Jews do go to college and become professors and do all kinds of things. The, I would say the main difference really is just the interpretation of whether Jewish law that was is binding for all Jews or not. And liberal Jews will say, no, we, our religion is constantly evolving and changing, and so we're going to evolve and change with the times, while traditional Judaism sort of wants to freeze it in sort of a certain time period. It's not the biblical time period, it's more like 1700s Europe. And sort of freeze it like that, like and that, and while the other, we're sort of letting things flow.
Can you say a brief word about the delineation between your ordaining denomination and Reformed, which you currently serve?
Sure. So I was ordained Reconstructionist, and I serve a Reformed congregation, all in the liberal denominations. The denomination in which I was ordained is a smaller denomination, and it was founded by Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan, who was an Orthodox rabbi, but then had the opportunity as an immigrant to this country from Lithuania to attend City College in New York City, where he studied anthropology and sociology and history, and he came, and basically what he decided was, there's no way that we can be the chosen people. So chosenness was his sort of where he deviated from the tradition. That look, there's basically our idea about it now is everyone's chosen. That we were maybe chosen to do something in a specific way, but he rejected chosenness, and he also rejected the concept of a supernatural God. And so the denomination that I was ordained in is one that holds intellectual honesty and integrity above pretty much everything. And that's where, and so it's a smaller denomination. And what's interesting about our curriculum is that it's civilizational. So the first year you basically are totally immersed in biblical civilization. The second year is rabbinic, then medieval civilization, modern and contemporary. Mm-hmm. And so you just spend a year, and then you, of course you have to study Hebrew and Aramaic throughout, but it sort of focuses on the scope of Jewish civilization, not giving one time period any more value over the other. And what traditional Judaism does is it values the rabbinic and medieval era more than the biblical or modern or contemporary, while we try to take from all eras of Jewish civilization. So a piece of Yiddish poetry might have just as much meaning as a second century rabbinic text. It's all beautiful, it's all wonderful, it's all from our civilization. Yes?
How does the population of Israel break down in terms of the liberal and traditional?
I would say it's probably 50-50 in terms of people who are sort of more towards the traditional, but the vast majority of Israelis, like 70% I would say, are non-halachic, meaning they don't necessarily follow Jewish law. So if you go to Tel Aviv on Saturday, stores are open, you can eat all kinds of treif, non-kosher stuff there. You know, there's pork and there's shrimp and people are enjoying themselves with that stuff. So Israel is not necessarily, while they have a lot of religious stuff going on, the population of Israelis, we don't necessarily want to live under rabbinic law. And they choose not to, and it's because it's a democracy, they can choose not to. One of the things you'll know about, or notice about Israel's government, is that the reason that they have a right-wing coalition in power is because those who are on the political right, but who are not necessarily religious, form coalitions with the most religious parties. And so if we had a parliamentary system here, you could see how that could work. That there might be people who are fiscal conservatives who are forming coalitions with right-wing evangelicals because they have some things in common. So Israel's parliament, it's not that the majority of their population is right-wing necessarily or even religious, but the way it plays out in terms of forming a coalition. And they have a parliament because they were, you know, that land was occupied by the British before Israel was formed. And so much of Israel's government is modeled off of the British system and not our system.
No, yes. Yeah, it's interesting. Judaism believes in that in one God, okay?
Yes.
And that's where Christianity took off. And on the other hand, you say you do not necessarily believe in that God as a person, like you see maybe in Christian tradition. So in a way, you could say Judaism is not a religion, it's a,
right.
it's a civilization, and you could actually be atheist, right?
Well, there's a lot of atheists who are Jews.
Yeah, so,
I mean, I would say a lot of people who come to the synagogue are atheists. They don't believe in God. I mean, if you ask them, did you believe in God? They'll probably say, well, I don't know. So they're agnostic, or no.
But they would always call themselves, consider them, their identity is Jewish,
yes.
Right? And the identity is probably based on the scriptures, on that.
I think that probably for those people, their identity is based on their heritage.
Okay.
So it'd be more their heritage or their lineage or their ancestry as opposed to having a relationship necessarily with scripture. Yes, go ahead, and we'll take
how
it back.
How could you, the story of Moses, it's so central, and Moses God appeared in the burning bush, so, I mean, if that story is part of the civilization, how could so many people be atheists? I mean, because God is right there. What?
Well, they can appreciate the story, but, you know, in order for something to be history, it has to have a secondary source.
Oh.
And so, we don't have a secondary source for the burning bush. So, you know, that's the thing. It's not history. You know, the Torah, there's aspects of the Torah that are historical, but it is not a historical document. And we don't read it as a historical document. Really, we read it as an inheritance, as a beautiful inheritance that does not necessarily, meaning we don't need it to be written by God for it to be important. And we don't actually even need it for it to be true, historically true, in order for it to be important. What's important is that we have passed it from generation to generation to generation for thousands of years, and that we still read it and we still go back to it and it still gives us life. But our consciousness has evolved, therefore our relationship to the text has evolved, but doesn't mean that we've abandoned it. I mean, that's where, you know, we're still very committed to the study of Torah, because it gives us life. We say it's a tree of life to those who hold fast to it. All its ways are ways of pleasantness. But that doesn't mean that you necessarily believe it was written by God or it was divinely created. And that is one of the, you know, one of the more difficult things to explain about liberal Judaism. Now, if you, you know, Albert Einstein, who grew up religious, did not consider himself to be a religious person. What he said is God is the mystery at the heart of reality. And that's probably the closest thing I could even say to a solid theological statement about the closest thing I believe to truth. But and I get it from a scientist and from an atheist who was a Jew. Yes.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say, that is this then also why there is not, quote, proselytizing, or why I am told by my Jewish friends, well, you just aren't a Jew. Well, I want to become a Jew. Well, it's about these German ancestors you have that were not Jews. And so it's that heritage, but also then if you marry into a Jewish family, all the traditions and everything that go with it, including synagogue, including temple, including everything, but I'm not sure how this God works in all of this.
Right.
Yeah.
And the thing is that it's also a journey for people.
Right.
Maybe people in their 30s don't believe in God, and maybe in their 60s they do. Like, I don't, you know, my job isn't to judge. My job is just to walk alongside the people I serve, you know, so
how do you work with someone who is a Gentile that wants to become a Jew?
Oh, so we do have conversion. Which actually ties really into my slide.
Oh, that's what I talked earlier. Yeah,
we are a people, a tribe, a nation, and we call Abraham and Sarah the first mother and father of our people. So when someone says they want to convert to Judaism, the tradition is you're supposed to turn them away 3 times.
Right.
Like, are you really sure you want to do this? I don't turn people away 3 times. What I do tell them is, I'm not going to come after you. Proselytizing is actually forbidden in Judaism. So if you want to become Jewish, it means you're going to have to show up, and you're going to have to make appointments with me. I'm not going to make appointments with you. And so It used to be that most people converting to Judaism were converting for marriage. Now, 95% of the weddings that I officiate are interfaith. I don't require people to convert for marriage. And so now the majority of people who are converting, it's so interesting, are women between 25 and 40 who are not married, coming out of a Christian tradition there because they're looking for something post-patriarchal. So interesting. Not expected. I was not trained to do as many conversions as we're doing because that it's not a big conversion religion. But when someone does convert, they take on the name, they choose a Hebrew name. So like my name's Yohanna, which is also my Hebrew and English name. And then you become Yohanna, daughter of Abraham and Sarah. That becomes your official identity, that you're adopted into the family and your parents. No one else gets to have Abraham and Sarah as their parents except for people who become Jewish by choice.
How is Judaism post-patriarchal?
So the forms are, the denomination and the form of Judaism that we practice being post-halachic means that we have more and more each day removing gender as an active category within our congregation. So we're post-patriarchal in that we are no longer considering gender to be a factor, because some people, now that we have more open non-binary people, that's a challenge to our community, right? If someone's non-binary and you're just completely gendered, where do they fit? So we've extracted gender from our worship, from our everything. Like there's no, in our denomination, there's no difference between what men and women can do at all. And you can also be a non-binary clergy member and function fully. So we took all the Jewish laws that had to do with separation of gender, and all the Jewish laws which were patriarchal in terms of giving men more power over women, and we decided we're just not doing those anymore, including lineality. So that's something that's big in Judaism, is your lineality. In biblical times, your identity was passed through your father. So you were an Israelite if your father was an Israelite. In post-biblical times, starting with the Mishnah, which was the first major Jewish book written after the destruction of the Second Temple, it was brought together around the year 300, they change it wholesale, and suddenly you're Jewish if your mother's Jewish.
When was that again?
Around the year between 200 and 300 of the Common Era, CE. So, and why? Why would you make such a radical change from this tribal patriarchal system to suddenly matriarchal? And it's because we were in exile and we no longer had the connection to the land. Mm-hmm. It makes sense for it to go from father to son when you're passing land. But when you've been, what I say, disembodied, you don't have the land as your body anymore. What's the closest thing to land that you have? Your mother's body. You know where you come from, your mother's body. Now, since the 1980s, we accept people as Jewish if their mother or father is Jewish. So that's the level of egalitarianism and moving away from being patriarchal. So that's how, you know, boys and girls, men and women, everybody's treated the same. And we've made that shift wholesale, and that is the majority of the Jewish world, even though it doesn't seem that way. It is. If you go into most synagogues, they're completely egalitarian.
So I'm curious, how are those decisions made and proclaimed?
Well, you have to have a lot of chutzpah, to decide that you're going to change Jewish law. But in Reform Judaism, the denomination I'm a part of, in Germany, in the 1800s, when they were Jews who were suddenly receiving higher educations, they opened a seminary for Reform rabbis, and they were very, very knowledgeable and wrote what we call teshuvot, which are basically changes to the law. And there's books and books and books of them for Reformed Jews of like, this is why we change this law. It doesn't just happen willy-nilly.
There must be a hierarchy.
There's not that much of a hierarchy in Judea. We don't have a pope. Every single synagogue in this country is its own independent 501c3. We don't have... And our denomination that we belong to, we give them money to support them, but they don't give us anything. Every synagogue chooses their own rabbi, has their own budget, and functions independently. So there is not a hierarchy necessarily. Any other questions about? Yes?
Just briefly back to the Abraham covenant. I understand the word nation in Genesis is the word goyim. And if that's true, what are the implications of that?
Well, there's a couple of words for nation. There's Am, which is also nation. So we see Am Yisrael, the people Israel. And Goyim refers explicitly to foreign nations. So there's Am is like our nation, and Goyim just means foreign nations, other nations, not our nation.
Is Goyim used in Genesis 12? Is Goyim used there?
I don't know. I'll have to look that up. I know that the word Goy, that Hebrew word, is in the Torah. So our central story, in terms of our identity, is the Exodus from Egypt. And we sing from the Song of the Sea every single service that we have, "Who is like you among the gods," which is what we sang when we crossed through. So this experience of having been slaves and now we're free, that redemption story is our central story. And when we talk about salvation, in Judaism, we've already been saved because the salvation happened when we were liberated from Egypt. That was our salvation. And so we were redeemed to go out and then to get the Torah at Mount Sinai and the instruction and the law, and then to march for 40 years towards the Promised Land. And so that's the story. In the Torah, the five books that we read, it ends with Moses not being able to go into the land. Like, what we read over and over and over again is mostly us wandering in the desert for 40 years. And we were going in circles, because it doesn't take 40 years to walk. So it's a story, we read the story over and over again about walking in circles in the desert and learning lessons. And that's given us life. Even for the most atheist Jew, that gives you life. Any questions about this, about the Exodus and
liberation?
You're saying that's sung even when it's not Passover.
Uh-oh.
Oops.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yes, that is sung even when it's not Passover. We see it at every service.
Wow.
And the liberation comes up, throughout the service. So, what I wanted to do with you next is talk about Jewish holidays, if that's okay. We talked about denominationalism, but I also wanted to go through the holidays. So I'm going to give you a circle. And so we're right here, we're in July. And we don't have a lot of summertime holidays, but in August, August 10th is the holiday Tisha, which is the 9, Be'av, the 9th of Av, and that's the day that we commemorate the destruction of the first temple and the second temple, and also the expulsion from Spain. In our sort of mythology, all those things happened on the same day. We know they didn't really, but we commemorate, it's a day of commemorating destruction, what people can do to other people and taking them down to their studs as a civilization. We read Lamentations, sit on the floor. It's a day of ashes and sackcloth kind of day, and we fast. And this year there's a national call to dedicate that day to Lamentations, specifically for children who are being detained. So on August 10th, and if you're in the Seattle area, we're going to be having an interfaith gathering and reading of Lamentations and sitting on the floor and doing the wailing. And it's our one, it's sort of, the release day, the day where you wail and you cry and you lament what human beings can do to each other and the planet. In my childhood, we always commemorated Hiroshima and Nagasaki Day when we celebrated Tisha B'Av, because in my childhood, that was the worst thing that, as Americans, we had done, and so we had destroyed another civilization. So one of our fast days. Then, shortly after that, we enter into the month of Elul, and this is a full month of preparation leading up to Rosh Hashanah, which is the new year. And during this month, it's basically mid-August to mid-September this year, it's time for reflection and what we call Cheshbon HaNefesh, which is accounting of your soul. So you're getting ready to stand before God, and so you're going through your last year. How did I miss the mark in my attempt to live a holy life? And so our word for sin in Hebrew is chet, which is actually an archery term, which means to miss the mark. So say, you know, this is a bullseye, and this is living a life of righteousness and holiness, and you at the beginning of the year, you shoot your arrow, hoping to live the most righteous life, and maybe you end up here, or you end up here. The month of Elul is the month of refinement. What am I going to do in this month to refine myself so that my arrow will shoot a little closer to the bullseye in the year ahead? And then at the end of this month is Rosh Hashanah, which is the Jewish New Year. But it's not like January. Rosh Hashanah is different. Rosh Hashanah actually commemorates the Big Bang. It commemorates creation. And so it would be in our thinking, this would have been the day that the Big Bang happened. And so it's the birthday of creation, not the birthday of the new year. So we will often in our services have imagery of the cosmos playing, showing throughout the service, using it as an opportunity to position ourselves within all of creation. And then 10 days later is Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement, which is sort of what we've been working up towards, which is a fast day. It's a day where we would not wear leather, don't drink, don't wear any makeup. It's like you're basically preparing for your death. I actually wear a garment, it's called a kittel, it's a white robe that I wear only on the high holidays, and it's what I'm going to be buried in. During this season, I put on my death garment, and that's what I lead the service in. And we open up the ark, and we say these prayers, and the ark is supposed to symbolize your coffin. That this is the day, once a year, where you really think, if I don't live beyond this year, how do I want to live? And facing that. And when that day is over, you go into the rest of your year. You can close that.
Okay.
Yes, somehow the slides did not show. After Yom Kippur, we have a holiday that you might be familiar with, Sukkot, which is the festival of booths. So we build a booth. Mine actually stays up all year, so I'm too lazy to take it down, and it's made of PVC piping, and it's around a picnic table, and at Sukkot, then we put branches on top of it. We decorate it, since it's a harvest holiday. We live in a place where there's a lovely harvest in October. That's usually when the holiday falls. We bring our pumpkins in and our apples, and it's a big harvest holiday. We eat in the booth for a week, have lots of potlucks around it. It's a celebratory festival holiday. And then after, that's Sukkot. After Sukkot, we have Simchat Torah, which I just already described, which is the holiday where we unroll the whole Torah scroll around the room. This is an exhausting season because most of this happens within a month period. So this year, Rosh Hashanah begins on September 29th. So we're mostly in October this year. And then most American Jews celebrate Halloween and Thanksgiving. So those are part of we don't necessarily do anything in the synagogue. For Thanksgiving, we do interfaith services. We like to do that. And then we have in December, around the New Year, Hanukkah. So Hanukkah is actually a really interesting holiday because it's not necessarily a religious holiday for us. In fact, the books of Maccabees, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, are not part of our canon. If you open up our Bible, you will not find any Maccabees in there. We did not keep that text as part of our sacred text. Does anybody have any ideas why? Why wouldn't we include Maccabees in our sacred text that we've been reading over the last 2,000 years?
Because of the time it happened?
It was written in Greek, too, wasn't it?
Not necessarily. What happens in the story?
Oh.
I mean, what do the Maccabees do?
Killing and destruction.
What was it?
The killing and destruction.
There was a lot of, yeah, they
but
were definitely...
it's similar to Joshua like that,
right.
And he had keep Joshua.
So that's actually the main part of it. It's a story of a small band of Jews rising up against this big, mighty nation. And, they fought them for 7 years. It wasn't like in the story where it just happens overnight. That story would not have been a helpful story for us in our history. We actually, so the way that the tradition was constructed was so that there was not a lot of emphasis on militarism or violence or fighting back or even protecting yourself. So, I mean, it's hard to see now Israel is such a militarized nation, but for the vast majority of our history, for 2,000 years, we were a non-weapon people. We did not fight back. When people came to kill us, we moved. That's why we moved around so much. And so having a story that you heard over and over again about fighting back, they did away with it. And the story we have instead is that when the Maccabees were able to recapture the temple from the Greeks, this is our focus, is that not the fighting part, they were recaptured the temple from the Greeks, and they weren't able to celebrate the 7-day holiday of Sukkot in the fall because it was under Greek occupation. And so they cleaned the temple, and this is where they found the oil for the Ner Tamid, for the eternal light. It was only supposed to last one day. It lasted a full week. What they were doing is they were actually celebrating Sukkot in December. Sort of like Christmas in July. because they hadn't been able to celebrate Sukkot in the fall, they celebrated a week-long festival in the wintertime. And that became what the holiday became for us, is the miracle of lights, not the miracle of a military victory. We almost never speak about that. The other complicating piece about the story of the Maccabees is that the majority of the Jews at that time wanted to be Hellenized. They loved the Greek culture. They were all about it. And these were actually like the radical, militant, religious right who were fighting back for the temple. Had the Maccabees not fought back for the temple, I mean, maybe we would have just assimilated into Greek culture then. I don't know. I mean, this is, you know, all we know is what happened, but we don't carry that story with us in the way that it's recorded in the Christian Bible, which I just think is so interesting. Yes?
I went to some Hanukkah parties when I lived in Minnesota, and one rabbi that I met there, Rabbi Yonason Gershom, told the story that when it came to that there wasn't enough oil, there was enough oil for one night, and it lasted 8 days, and he said that they actually screwed off the point of the spear and made this, there was like a bowl left in the spear, and they put the oil in the spear. Ooh. Have you heard that?
No, I haven't heard that.
That's the way he told it.
But one of the customs for Hanukkah is in the Talmud, they talk about this, is if you live in a time and place where it's safe for Jews to do so, put the menorah in your window so that you can publicize the miracle. What's the miracle? The miracle is that we survived. That's actually the miracle, is that we're still here. If you don't live in a place where it's safe, do not put that menorah in your window. You do not want to be attacked. And so when we can live in a place where we can put our menorahs in the window, we know this is a good place because we're safe enough to let people know that we're still here.
Yeah.
So Hanukkah has become a major holiday in America too, and you can buy Hanukkah decorations at Target. You know, it's like... That's pretty amazing. You know, we have the big blow-ups, and because of the influence of Christmas, it's just part of the whole season of lights, and we get way into it, and we have Hanukkah sweaters now, and the whole thing. We have ugly Hanukkah sweater contests and all kinds of things. So we get way into the Americanization of it, which is interesting because it was a holiday about pushing back against the dominant culture. That's the strength of capitalism. They get you sucked in there. So after Hanukkah, which is our major wintertime holiday, in January we have Tu B'Shvat. Shvat's a month, it's the 15th of Shvat. And this is the New Year's for the trees. It's a tree-based holiday, and it's the agricultural Israelite community, this is when you would start counting year one for a newly planted tree to be able to determine when tithing happens. Because you need to know, like, how old is this tree? And so it was originally an agricultural holiday that in the medieval times became a mystical holiday, focusing on all the mystical learning that we can do from trees. And so what we have at Tu B'Shvat now is Tu B'Shvat seders, where we sit down and we eat different kinds of things that come from trees. So we'll eat something that's soft on the inside but hard on the outside, that has like a peel, like an orange. something that is soft all the way through, something that is soft on the outside but hard on the inside. I'm trying to think about what the fourth one is. It's another kind of fruit. And we will talk about the meaning of all of that. Like, some people are soft on the outside but hard on the inside, or some people are hard on the outside but soft on the inside. And just diving deep in any way possible to the beauty of trees. We go on hikes, we plant trees, it's just a tree holiday. Again, you know, it started thousands of years ago as an agricultural thing, but Judaism's evolved over time, and so now it's become a major environmental holiday for us. After Tu'vi Shvat, we have Purim, which is when we read aloud the book of Esther. Have any of you been to a Purim celebration before?
Yeah.
So what are some of the things you remember about Purim?
It was kind of like Halloween.
Yes.
Dress up.
There was a real bad guy that was kind of a monster, and then everybody kind of booed him. And,
yes,
and
that's Haman.
It's very happy. I mean, there's a happy feeling.
It has the same sort of sociological function as Mardi Gras.
Yeah.
Or any of these other holidays around the world where everything is turned upside down one day. And so that's what Purim is. It's a holiday. It was sort of like, what's it called when people dress up like characters from like
cosplay.
It was very early cosplay because they would read the story and then everybody would dress up like the characters and come.
Yeah.
Now you can dress up like whatever you want, but traditionally people would dress up like the queen or the king or Haman, the villain, and you would come and you would hear the story read aloud, and whenever Haman's name was read, people would boo and hiss, we have something called groggers, which are noisemakers, to try to drown out his name. And he was this vicious anti-Semite during the time that we were in Babylonia, and over Jewish history, it became that whoever was the tyrant who dominated us at the time was Haman. So it was wherever we were in the world. If it was Hitler, Hitler was Haman. If it was the, you know, the landlord who was, you know, when we were living in Europe in 1200, that was Haman. And so it was one day a year where you could stomp on their name and scream and yell and act crazy. With your rage at your suffering, and then the next day everybody goes back to normal.
So, a lot of drinking, too.
A lot of drinking. Yeah, you're supposed to get so drunk that
so
you can't
drunk.
Tell the difference between Haman and Mordecai, who is Queen Esther's uncle. Yeah, there's two holidays where drinking is encouraged. One is Purim, and the other one is Simchat Torah. We don't really encourage drinking, but it's not looked down upon. It's a festival. Yes?
I was just curious what time of year that is.
Purim is usually in February.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
It's just before Passover.
One month exactly before Passover. A lot of our holidays, like Purim and Passover, happen always on full moons. Because that's when you could see and people would be able to travel to each other's homes. And so whenever it's full moon Purim, I tell the congregation, next time it's a full moon, you're going to be sitting at your Seder. You go outside, and it's been the same full moon, same night for thousands of years. See, the moon hasn't changed.
Yeah.
We have, but the moon stays the same, and so is the time of the holiday. After Purim, as we've just said, we have Passover on the next full moon. That's where we sit down and we tell the story of leaving Egypt. Passover is a very rabbinic holiday, though it was a holiday that Jesus celebrated. The way that we celebrate it is not the way that Jesus celebrated it. So Jesus would have been celebrating a biblical Passover, and we celebrate a rabbinic Passover. And so he didn't have the Haggadah. He didn't have the four cups of wine. It was not the same celebration. The rabbis in the rabbinic period created Passover as a tool to teach children. So the number four is repeated throughout the dinner. We drink four cups of wine. There are four children in the story who ask questions, four different types of children. There's four questions, and we also hide something, sort of like at Easter, we hide a piece of matzah during the meal, and the children, we can't finish the meal until the children find it and bring it back to us. So the whole thing was really designed, the whole Passover Seder, to pass on this identity of we used to be slaves in Egypt and now we're free and we're walking towards the promised land. That's the Passover Seder. Yes.
The Seder, I've only been to a couple Seders, but one I went to in Minnesota, they started talking about who was your Pharaoh in your life, and so somebody might have had issues with drinking or some bad thing, and they talk about that as the Pharaoh. So I didn't realize it was applied like that to so personally.
Yes.
To people's lives.
Yeah, well, we say in the Seder, you should feel like you personally left Egypt tonight.
Yeah.
That, and in our Moroccan tradition, we actually take the Seder plate that has all the symbolic foods, which in Roman times would have been the whole meal. So in Jesus' time, that what's on the Seder plate, the lamb bone,
yeah,
the bitter herbs, the horseradish, the egg, the chopped up nuts and carrots, that would have been the meal.
Uh-huh.
And over time it became symbolic foods and we ate other things for the meal.
Yeah.
But they put a cloth over the Seder plate and someone runs around the table and you're supposed to feel the cloth tickle the back of your neck and that's supposed to be the wind of the Sea of Reeds.
Wow.
That you're feeling. So you're supposed to like really talk about cosplay. You're supposed to like really get into that you were a slave and you were in a place of narrowness and constriction and we are going through, and the language I like to use, is we're going through the birth canal of freedom. And so we're going through the birth canal, going through the waters to the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And then we always, at our Seders, talk about who are we bringing with us this mm-hmm. year through the birth canal of freedom. So keeping those themes of freedom and redemption alive, they've given us life, but now when we protest the child detentions, we held up signs that say, fighting tyrants since Pharaoh.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's our trajectory, that's sort of the world view, is that in every generation there's going to be a tyrant who's going to try to dominate you or other people, and we always have to be ready to push back tyranny. After Passover, our next holiday is Shavuot. Which is, I think in the Christian tradition, it's Pentecost.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we count 7 weeks, 49 days between Passover and Shavuot, and this holiday, traditionally it was an agricultural holiday that had to do with the barley harvest, which is why we read the book of Ruth at Shavuot, and also a time when there was a lot of baby cows and sheep being born. So one of the central themes of this holiday is eating cheesecake and blintzes. It's a dairy holiday, and there's a great focus on dairy products for this holiday. Sometimes we build a Mount Sinai Sunday because we also commemorate the giving of the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai on Shavuot too. It's a holiday that we often associate with people who come into Judaism, convert to Judaism because of the Book of Ruth, being traditionally read at this season. And then we don't have any holidays again until Tisha B'Av. What?
Not true.
Which one?
Shabbat.
That's right. Well, Shabbat is every week. I know. Then we have Shabbat every single week, which is... Yeah, Shabbat just keeps coming. And Shabbat is a holiday. From sundown on Friday night to sundown on Saturday is a 25-hour period of rest and renewal. So... one good example of the difference between how liberal Jews celebrate Shabbat and how traditional or halakhic Jews is that, and according to Jewish law, there's a long list of things that you cannot do on the Sabbath. Where does this list come from? The list comes from all the activities that were done in building the portable tabernacle in the desert, the Mishkan. So in the Mishkan, in building the Mishkan, they hammered and they cut things and they boiled things. And so there's a list of over 50 rules that are associated directly with actions from building the tabernacle. And those are the things that are prohibited to do. So there's, and how did they get there? Because the Torah says you shall do no manner of work on the Sabbath. And the rabbis wanted to know, well, what is work? How do we define work? And so then they saw that the work of building the Mishkan, they use the same Hebrew word, malacha, so like, okay, that's what it must mean. Is anything that would have happened to build the Mishkan, the portable tabernacle, are the specific things that are not allowed. And a lot of Jewish legal-based Shabbat observance is about what you can't do. Well, that didn't fly for a lot of modern Jews, and so in liberal Jewish communities, we focus on what you can do. So instead of focusing on the nots, we focus on the do's. And so if people choose not to spend money or drive or pick flowers or cook on the Sabbath, that's for their own personal, you know, that's their decision. In our community, we just encourage people. We encourage people to take time in nature, to take time for community, to study Torah, to take time for prayer and meditation. And so that's just the difference in approach. We're not going to ever prohibit anybody, people from practicing in a more traditional way, but we're not going to encourage people to only practice in a traditional way. Any questions about Shabbat?
Can I ask about the place of the renewal festivals of Ezra and Nehemiah?
We don't do that much about that, no. Mm-mm. It's interesting what has stuck over thousands of years and what's dropped away. And that's sort of some of, I'm going to talk about challah in a minute. Was there another question here? Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we were in a hotel in Jerusalem on Shabbat, and it was a traditional hotel, and they suggested don't use the elevator on the left, use the elevator on the right, if you want to get to your 10th floor.
Yes.
Today.
Right, because the elevator on the right
stops
at every floor.
Stops at every floor.
Yes.
Because
you don't push the button.
The only Shabbat I've been at, there was a ritualistic washing. So is that done with the liberal approach?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Hand washing.
Okay.
Yes.
What does Shabbat have to do? You said it relates to the Christian Pentecost. What is Shavuot?
Oh, Shavuot is, Pentecost, I believe, is
50 days.
50 days after
Easter.
Easter. Mm-hmm. And Shavuot is 49 days or on the 50th day after the first Seder.
Yeah.
Okay, it has nothing to do with the Holy Spirit.
Huh? No, no.
No, no.
They're just at the same time.
Okay.
Yes.
What is a tabernacle?
The portable tabernacle. So, in the story of the Torah, at Mount Sinai, God gives instructions, build me a sanctuary and I will dwell amongst you. And then all these architectural designs are offered up for building a portable, a tent that they would build it. And inside the tent was where, or outside in the courtyard, would be where there would be sacrifices made. And then as you go into the tent, there's several layers, but in the most holy layers where the Ark of the Covenant is, and that's where the Holy of Holies was, and that was considered where God's divine, the Shekhinah, God's spirit that dwelt on earth, would hover around there or be close to that area. And so it was this idea that we were building a place for God to dwell with amongst us, and then later it became the temple in Jerusalem, would have been sort of the permanent version of that, but there was a tent in the Torah.
Tell me what happens when Shabbat falls on a holiday, like it's Passover and Shabbat at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've heard this, but I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, there's always going to be a Shabbat during Passover,
right?
And it just,
or Yom Kippur might be a better example.
Yeah.
Doesn't Shabbat prevail or something?
Well. A lot of, there are things, for example, one thing that prevails is if Yom Kippur is happening and if there's a Jewish baby, male baby who's born, you would have a circumcision on Yom Kippur. That's something that's allowed. But that's the only thing that really sort of supersedes Yom Kippur.
Okay.
They try to make the calendar work, or they did historically, so it wouldn't fall on Yom Kippur because you're not supposed to fast on Shabbat. Shabbat's always supposed to be a day of celebration.
Okay.
In the Jewish years, life cycle, when someone who is Jewish passes away, we sit Shiva or sit for a week in their memory or honor. But that is broken by Shabbat. Shabbat is, so if you're in mourning, you need to stop your mourning and engage in Shabbat and then pick back up where you left off. Any other questions about the holiday cycle?
How many vacation days do you get in the year to do all of this?
You know, before 2008, 2016, honestly, it felt more like it was hard to balance the secular calendar and the Jewish calendar. You say that as Jews we live with in two civilizations, like my glasses. I'm always looking through the Jewish lens and my secular lens and trying to integrate them. Same thing with my calendar. I have this extensive Jewish calendar and my secular calendar. But since 2016, I've actually so appreciated being able to live according to the Jewish calendar. There's something about it where it's like a sanctuary for me to be able to live in this cycle. And I just look forward, when there's not a lot of things to look forward to, sometimes I just look forward to the next Shabbat, the next holiday, the next holiday, because there's always a holiday coming up. And we like to get crafty and cook and decorate for all the holidays. So, you know, it's not just like decorating a couple times a year. It's like, what centerpiece are we going to have for Purim or for Passover? And so it leads to a life of living from one joyful event to the other. And I've really been appreciating that the last couple of years of my life. Since the election, where you know my worldview about sort of where we were headed as a, you know, as a society has shifted, and I've just found much more comfort in, you know, feeling drawn, like maybe I just want to live in this cycle, and not so much in the other cycle. Then so, but I living a balanced life, just appreciating having the next thing to look forward to, the next holiday to look forward to.
But you know, if you're like a professional and you can only get certain days off, which is the priority day? Like what?
All rabbis have Monday off.
If you're not a rabbi, if you're just like working in any other field, and you can only get like, I don't know, 5 days off or whatever, what would be the priority days, like the most crucial?
The holidays?
Yeah.
I would say Passover and probably Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. But and in Israel, they have, you know, they take off school for all these holidays. So you can imagine, because we have a couple of week-long holidays, that there's a lot of school off for these holidays. Also interestingly about Israel is that adults have Friday and Saturday off of work, but children only have Saturday off of school, which means that all the adults in the country have a full day off without their children being home. Which I think is pretty amazing. Wow. So you go to these cafes and I've got these couples looking so happy, without their children. It's quite lovely. I don't know why we do it this way here. okay, well, I have moved now then to the life cycle from the holiday cycle and sort of just take you through the rituals and customs of living a life. So you're a little baby and you're born into a Jewish family. For boys, traditionally there would be a ritual circumcision on the eighth day after their birth. And for girls, they would have a baby naming. It could be on the eighth day, but it could also be maybe on the new moon, because the new moon, Rosh Chodesh, is associated as a woman's holiday. So sometimes people wait till the next new moon. Any questions about ritual circumcision?
Is it done by a doctor?
So traditionally it was done by someone called a mohel, and that was their job in the community to be a ritual circumciser. Now we have, like in our denomination, we have an effort to train pediatric urologists to be mohels. So the person I work with is on Mercer Island. He's a pediatric urologist. All he does is circumcisions for Jews and Muslims. Like all he has is whole business.
Wow. And so what would it be like for a family that made a different decision in your community? You
know? In my community?
Yeah.
In my community, I do a baby naming for whoever wants a baby naming. So I would do for a boy what we do for a girl without the ritual.
So some people make that decision and it's acceptable with reform.
Not every reform rabbi would be okay with it, but I am. So if someone comes to me and says, I have a baby, we've decided not to circumcise, then I would say, I'll give you, you know, we'll do a baby naming and we'll do a blessings and everything the same, just no cutting. What I did have once is a couple who came, and an interfaith couple, and they wanted me to pretend like I did it for your father. They're like, well, we'll bring you the baby, and you just pretend, like, I don't even do circumcisions. Pretend like you're doing it because the father would be so upset, like the grandfather, if it didn't happen. I told him no. That I'm not going to pretend to do a circumcision. But it's a very intense thing to decide not to for some families. It's like a big deal. And so, so we have ritual circumcision and baby namings. If the baby is sick or anything that would threaten its life, we would not do the circumcision until they were healthy. Most of them happen either in the home or the synagogue. So it's a home-based ritual. We're often singing to the baby as it's happening, and they're being held by their godparent. And so it's not, a medical circumcision takes about 45 minutes in the hospital. A ritual circumcision usually takes like around 45 seconds. It's really fast. Wow. And they use a topical anesthesia. And one of the things that we do often is dip our finger in wine and let the baby suck on it also. That's sort of a custom. Anything else about it?
Was it originally for health reasons that it was started? Like,
no, I think it was originally body marking. It was tribal body marking.
Tribal body marking.
Mm-hmm.
I see.
Yeah, it's marking your body to be part of the tribe.
Okay.
You know, so it would be like any kind of tribal body marking that exists anywhere in the world.
I see.
And actually, the mystics in the Middle Ages said that what you're doing is you're carving the yud, the letter yud of God's name, into your body.
Oh, wow.
So they actually saw it as like carving godliness into your body. Yeah. But that's what I say tribe. When I refer to this, you know, to ourselves as a tribe. People who are atheists and don't even believe in God still circumcise their children. So what's that about? Well, it's about being part of a tribe. It's about the community and the connection to our ancestry. Then, around preschool, around 3 years, most Jewish children who are being raised with religion, the religion of Judaism, would start studying and learning the Hebrew alphabet and learning of the stories of our people, just like Sunday school, in a Christian context. And then leading up to 12 and a half for girls and 13 for boys when they become a bar or bat. And now we're trying to use more so we can be non-gendered b-mitzvah. We're just going to call it a b-mitzvah because we have non-binary kids too. And so it's a coming-of-age ceremony and ritual where I will do a bar bat mitzvah for any child, whether they're going to read from the Torah or not. I believe that every Jewish child should have a coming-of-age ritual. So even if they're secular and they want nothing to do with the religious aspects, we'll do some kind of celebration of their adulthood. But in our synagogue, for example, this Saturday morning, the child will stand up on the podium with me and we'll lead the whole service together. And then they will read from the Torah scroll in Hebrew, often chanting it, and then give a Devar Torah, give a short sermon about their portion, and talk about what it means to become a Jewish adult in the community. And then with everything that we have, every single celebration has a seuda, a meal, or a festive meal. Like, we always have a festive meal. There's never a time, even in Yom Kippur, we end with a festive meal. So always a meal afterwards. The next big life cycle or ritual event would be, in Reform Judaism, interestingly, confirmation. In Reform Judaism, when it came to the United States, decided that 13 was just too young for a child to become an adult, and they tried to do away with it. Totally. And it didn't stick. So what we ended, and they wanted to replace it with confirmation at 16, which I think they took from, I don't know where they got it.
Lutherans.
Is that where they got it? Yeah, it was. I mean, they really wanted it to become more like Protestant Christianity. And so they said, well, 16 is when we're going to confirm. And what we ended up with is Bar Mitzvah at 13 and confirmation at 16. So we do both now. We also do a confirmation, which is really amazing. Thank you for your Lutheran wisdom about 16-year-olds. Because the difference that you see in terms of how kids at 13 speak about their identity and kids at 16 is huge. huge. And so to give them another opportunity to be able to have a ritual that confirms their identity at 16 is just such a gift. And I was confirmed at 16 and had a chance to speak publicly. And what we usually do is, it usually actually happens on the holiday of Shavuot, and the kids take turns reading the Ten Commandments in Hebrew from the Torah scroll, and then they will give a little speech about what being Jewish means to me. And it's interesting because some of the kids say, I don't believe in God, I believe, and then they talk about what they do believe in. I do believe in community. I do believe in our heritage. I do believe in this. And so we allow them to not believe in God. They don't have to. They can say that publicly. We're not threatened by it. It doesn't diminish Judaism. It just doesn't. And so, and those are the kids who've stayed through 16, and they're most likely to stay involved for the rest of their lives, in part because we give them permission to be where they are at the time where they are. After confirmation, the next big life cycle event would be a Jewish wedding. In our denomination, Reform and Reconstructionist, we officiate LGBTQIA weddings and have for a long time, long before it was legal, according to American law. And the Jewish, have any of you been to a Jewish wedding? So it's a lovely ceremony, I think. I do a lot of them. The couple stands underneath the chuppah, so here they are, and which is a wedding canopy. You probably saw it in Fiddler on the Roof. Basically, what you're trying to do is create this beautiful space when you might not have a beautiful space for a wedding. And so you take four branches, and you put a lace tablecloth on top of it, and your friends and family hold it in the middle of a field, and that becomes the place where you are married, and the tablecloth and the branches represent your home. The couple come underneath the chuppah, and we start with a blessing for wine, sweetest thing on earth. They will exchange rings, and traditionally what they would say to each other is an Aramaic phrase, which is, with this ring you are holy and consecrated to me according to the laws of Moses and Israel. And that's the vow that's exchanged. And after they exchange rings and words, then we just give them lots and lots of blessings. And the ceremony ends with the breaking of a glass, which traditionally was about warding away evil spirits. But we interpret it many different ways, including that your love will last as long as it takes to put back together this glass, which is impossible because it's completely shattered. Jews also, like Muslims, have a ketubah, which is a wedding contract. And I think it's called a katab.
Yeah.
And so it's a legal document that is signed before the wedding. Traditionally, the ketubah was essentially selling the bride to the husband from the father. It's a document that says that in exchange for this bride, this is her dowry, and it's not signed by the bride traditionally. It's just signed by the husband and the witnesses. I don't use that document in the weddings I do. What I do is I still have the tradition of having a written document, but it's more like the vows that a couple would say to each other. So it's the commitments that you're making. It's often a piece of artwork. So mine is text within art, and it hangs above our bed. And so it's, what I always tell a couple is, it's the mission statement for your marriage. And whenever you get lost, you can go back to it and say, this is what we agreed to, and it hangs prominently in your house and reminds you of your covenant. It's a covenantal document. When people get divorced in Jewish tradition, and traditionally only men could divorce women were not allowed to divorce men. We don't do that anymore. In liberal Judaism, Orthodox Judaism, it is still that way. But what we do when someone gets divorced is the couple brings us their ketubah, and we tear it in half right in front of them. That's what you do. Super intense. but it's about the tearing and the breaking of this covenant, so it's very visceral. That's what happens to the ketubah when people get divorced. And then the next major life cycle event would be death. And so in the Jewish tradition, we have a lot of rituals around mourning. And one of my professors says that Buddhists have the wisdom around dying, but Jews have really great wisdom around mourning. because we have extensive mourning practice. And so when someone dies in the Jewish tradition, our custom is to bury them within 24 hours if possible, because you're not supposed to do anything to the body. So no embalming or doing anything to preserve the body. That's why we had to get in the ground as quickly as possible. Now you can use people's organs and eyes and skin for donations. Anything that will help save a life or make someone's life better, the laws have changed so that you can do something to the body, but only for the benefit of humanity. So you bury as soon as possible. Ideally, just straight into the ground, no nothing except for maybe being wrapped in a sheet, wearing your burial garments, which are white linen. I believe they are in Islam too, is it?
Yeah, I don't even know if we have garments, but we have the white sheet.
The white sheet, yeah. So my grandfather in Israel, when he was buried, he was just brought out on a gurney, wrapped in a white sheet, and they just tipped him over into the hole in the ground. So it's a very, very visceral experience. In the United States, because you actually have to be in a coffin, as according to law, we bury in a plain pine box. But green funerals are really the ideal Jewish funeral would be a green funeral. Just straight into the ground, that's it, back to the earth.
Do you practice cremation?
I do funerals for people who've been cremated, but technically cremation was not allowed. It was from biblical times, just the idea of going right to the earth. And then the Holocaust made cremation sort of even more difficult,
yes,
because part of the insult to injury of the Holocaust was all these people being burned,
right,
when that was not how we did things. But there's a lot of good arguments for cremation, although now that we can do the decomposing and becoming soil in Washington State, that's even better. So, because there's an environmental impact for any kind of death practice, but for a long time people couldn't... why do I need to take up this plot of land for eternity when it could be for food or for housing? And so more and more Jews over time have decided that they would rather be cremated than buried for environmental purposes, sometimes for financial purposes, because plots are really, really expensive now. Now that we have a lot more options with green burial and all kinds of things, people are choosing that too. I'll do a funeral memorial service for someone, even if they're being cremated. After someone is buried or cremated, then we have a week-long period of mourning. So when my father passed away, we sat Shiva, which means we basically sat in the house for a week and reminisced and prayed and sang. And there's an intensive period for the first week. Then there's after the first month, you would do a shloshim after the first 30 days. There, usually what you'll do is maybe host a gathering in honor of that person. Nothing necessarily formal. And then mourning, the intensive mourning of saying daily prayers for the person who's departed happens for every day for a year. So the first year after a death, you would mark by saying a special prayer for the dead every single day. Now, traditionally that happened in the synagogue. What I encourage people to do is just take time every day for memory for that person. So, and then after the first year, you then are really encouraged to get back into things. So there's sort of this idea that there's the first week, super intensive mourning the first year, but you're not allowed to continue to be in a state of intense mourning, that we have to get back to life. And so there, throughout the year, we end up having times where special holidays where you do come, and it would be a time to say the prayer for the mourning. But then after the first year, you go back to celebrations and parties. During the first year, if you don't go to a bar mitzvah or a wedding, it's understood, because it might not be appropriate. And so there's just a lot about how do you walk with the mourner along their path and be with them as they transition from one place in life to another.
Is that for just immediate family? And then what if, like, I have friends that have converted to Judaism, and then the children, would they mourn for their Methodist grandfather that passed away for a year?
Yes. So if you're Jewish, if you lose your mother or your father or a sibling, then you would do the mourning regardless of whether they were Jewish or not. What's hard is when people convert to Judaism and no one is Jewish in their family, because then there's no one to mourn for them. Mm-hmm. And that's where the community comes in. How are we doing on time?
It's about
time?
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. So that's the life cycle. We've talked about the year cycle and the denominations. In the last 5 minutes, are there any other questions I can answer? Yes.
Me?
Yeah, go ahead, and then behind you.
Can you speak to the Torah portions and what that is?
Yeah, so the Torah is divided up to 52 portions, and we read one every single week, starting, it was Genesis, and going all the way through the end of Deuteronomy. And right now we're reading, this week we'll be reading the story of Balak and Bilam, and then the next week we'll move on to the next portion, and we do it over and over and over again, which is wonderful because we study the same portion over and over and over again, and every year you learn something different. Mm-hmm. You notice something different. It's just, it's amazing that the returning to the text.
I'm wondering if you can say any more about remembrance, if the stories and everything are about coming from ancestors. So what is the reverence, or what are the prayers or rituals just for the ancestry and keeping them alive? Or how do you keep them with you?
Yes. One of our central prayers is a prayer where we say, we give thanks to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Sarah, Rachel, Rebecca, and Leah. And so throughout the prayer, our liturgy, are references to, we are living because of the merit of our ancestors. We are remembering the actions of our ancestors. So the liturgy really draws you back to remembering your ancestors. And then having mourning and a mourner's prayer as part of every single prayer service, we say, who are you remembering tonight? Because it would be the anniversary of someone's death. And people will say the names of the people they're remembering. And then we also say this prayer for everyone who doesn't have someone to say the mourner's prayer for them. Those who are in unmarked graves or those whose whole families were lost. And so it's really about memorializing and remembering everyone who we've lost and just gathering those ancestors. So in some ways the ancestor stuff is not unlike in some Asian cultures. I would say it's ancestor veneration, but there's definitely the idea in the Torah in terms of the afterlife that your soul is gathered back to the soul of your people. And so that connection to your ancestry is kept very strong. Yes?
That's kind of about my question. I was wondering if you could expand on the beliefs of the afterlife. I remember in the environmental talk,
right,
you said that there were not a lot of beliefs about the afterlife, which is in such stark contrast to Christianity. But that's a power play held over people, you stray and you go to hell.
Right.
So I'm just wondering if you could expand on that.
So the first references to the afterlife in the book of Genesis are when Jacob died and his soul was gathered to the soul of his people. Mm. So I would say, I guess the first concept of the afterlife in the Torah is of the collective family soul. And then over the course of Jewish history we obviously had heaven and hell during Second Temple time, because that's where Christianity got it from, was from this idea of heaven and hell. So we did have that in our consciousness, but we also have had reincarnation come up, resurrection of the dead is part of it. So all kinds of stuff. If you look at the scope of Jewish history, basically every belief in the afterlife has existed. And I think because Christianity ran with the afterlife stuff, Judaism just dropped it. It's like we talk about it in stories, but I would never give a sermon about the afterlife unless I was explaining what I just said here. Which is that we have all these different beliefs and no one really knows, and we don't, but that Judaism is focused on this world and not on the world to come, and so we just don't talk about it. It's just not, which is not comforting for some people. Some people really want to know and they want to have a belief, and those are people for whom Judaism might not be very satisfying. Judaism is a religion of a lot of questions and very few answers. So if you like questions, it's a good thing. If you want answers, you're gonna feel disappointed.
What is the essence of your message or your prayer over a departed loved one?
So the mourner's prayer, which is actually written in Aramaic, is an affirmation of life. So that's basically how we mourn the dead, is by affirming life. Any other?
I've heard. I've heard so often the phrase from Jews comforting me, like after the, may his memory be a blessing.
Yes.
And that's just like the sort of thing that he said. May his memory be a blessing.
Yes, that's the phrase. That's how we comfort each other. Is may his or her memory be a blessing, and that means that that's the part of them that's still alive is a blessing that they brought to this world.
Yes. That variety of ways of looking at afterlife or lack thereof, is that just in progressive Judaism, or is that traditional Judaism the same thing? There's not really a big deal about afterlife.
In traditional Judaism, they might talk about heaven and hell more in storytelling, but even in Orthodox Judaism, the rabbis are not going to give sermons about, it's not going to be an active teaching concept. It's not going to be something that's brought actively into the community. It's much more in parables, like a story about this and this happens, and then this person goes to the world to come. And those stories, from the way I read them, is really about reflection, about living. The stories we tell about dying, what happens after we die, often are a reflection about how we feel about this place.
Yes. Along with the 52 readings from Torah, do you have corresponding readings from Navim or Avivim?
Yes. So every week they will take a piece of the prophets or the additional writings that make up our full text, and they will associate it thematically with what we're reading from the Bible. And so that's why how we get to hear all those other texts read aloud too. And that was a later innovation, but it's so that we have more exposure to text.
Okay, I think it's time.
It's time.
It's time.
Well, thank you all so much.